All right, members, we're going to get started. So if you please take your seats. We have a very full agenda today. So we're going to start with a continuation of introducing our ed orgs. And I would ask, respectfully ask them to please, please keep it to 2 minutes if you can. We have a 30-second little sign that our CLA, Laura Helgen, will hold up to remind you to keep speeding along, because we have two really amazing presentations afterwards, and we want to give time for the presentations and questions. So we are going to start right away with the Association of Secondary Principals and Elementary Principals, and then on deck is the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Club. So if you can come down together, and then after that, the Association of Colleges and Teacher Education. And, oh, sorry, I'm being reminded, I completely forgot. We actually first have a quorum, and second, we need the minutes to approve, and I see Representative Baker with his hand out.
Madam Chair, I'd like to approve the minutes as presented.
Representative Baker made a motion to approve the minutes. Any questions? All right, and then minutes. Seeing none, sorry, I'm a little lost here. Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. All right, now we're going to move on, and I promise I'll eventually get the hang of that. So, like I said, first of all, we have Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals and Elementary Principals. And Mr. Roger Aronson, could you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the elementary principals, secondary principals, and as you can see from the list, I also represent the Minnesota State High School League. And it's a pleasure to be here this morning, or this afternoon, rather, and to those of you that have been on the committee for a while, it's good to see you again, and there are a lot of new members to this committee. School principals have a very keen interest in the work of this committee and have for a very, very long time. We'll have some issues that all interest us this year that we'll bring here. We'll want to talk about the Labor Day school start, probably be some school discipline issues that come up. We certainly, and you'll be amazed at the number of issues that come forward. We would ask you, when you go through these issues, to look very, very closely. You'll hear about, should we repeal some mandates? It's really hard to repeal mandates. And one of the things that we found through the years is it's difficult to pass bills, and it is really difficult to undo them once they're passed. They have a constituency that exists for a long time, and while everyone thinks mandate repeal is a good idea, it's hard to do. We'd ask you on the front end to say, can the local school board do this? Should this be at the local school board when you're looking at those questions? Should this be a state policy? Have you heard from all sides on it? Very often you're just going to hear from one side. There's going to be a quiet group that you won't hear from. Explore those opinions or positions that those groups may have as well before you make decisions that are going to bind us for a long time. I might just point out that last year the K-12 policy bill was vetoed, and it didn't go into effect. We do a series of workshops in the fall and said to our school principals, and about 700 of the 2,000 go through the workshops, was there anything you needed in last year's K-12 bill that you couldn't live without? And the answer to that was no. There was a lot of work that went last year, but do we need these as mandates? So explore that as the questions come before you, and not just with you know, the other people. I mean for the things that my clients bring forth as well. I might say I also represent the High School League. You're going to have a constituent who is concerned that they're ineligible for some reason. Talk to us. We'll talk to you about why. You'll have all kinds of issues that will come to you that people will want resolved. A good thing to keep in mind is the High School League resolves a lot of issues for you. We set up conferences. We set up tournament size. We set up the number of games kids can play during the year. We say no from time to time about things. And everybody has an idea because everybody's participated in extracurriculars and on down the line. But I have to say, a lot of them can't get solved at this table. I want to thank Representative Baker for his comments last week about following his principals around in his home district, and I would recommend that activity to all of you, to spend time in your schools. We look forward to working with you, and we think we're going to have an excellent year. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. And you know, I did give him a little bit more time because he wears many hats, so a few different organizations you covered there. So next is Minnesota Alliance of Boards, Boys and Girls Club.
Hello, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Brian Donaldson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance of the Boys and Girls Clubs. The Alliance represents 10 Boys and Girls Clubs organizations at more than 40 locations throughout the state, including three organizations with clubs at White Earth, Leech Lake, and Red Lake reservations. Almost 50,000 kids ages 6 to 18 come through the doors of the Boys and Girls Clubs in Minnesota, making us the largest statewide provider of youth development and out-of-school programs. Clubs are located where kids need us most. 67% of the youth we serve qualify for free and reduced lunch. Boys and Girls Clubs fill the gap between school and home, providing safe environments where kids have fun, participate in life-changing programs, and form supportive relationships with peers and adults. Our goal is to assure success is within reach of every young person who enters our doors, with all members on track to graduate from high school with a plan for the future, demonstrating good character, citizenship, and living a healthy lifestyle. Educational programming is a large, integral part of our mission. Our education programs seek to provide complementary learning and enrichment both after school and all summer long. Programs are on STEM, computer science, literacy, college readiness, and career exploration, as well as homework help, have led to a 95% of our teen members expecting to graduate on time. The Boys and Girls Clubs work to partner with schools and parents to make sure our youth reach their full potential as productive, caring, responsible citizens. I look forward to visiting with you further about our pilot K-3 literacy program, which has shown reading gains in 95% of our participants at our Minneapolis and St. Paul sites, with those considered below grade level making the largest gains. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. And next is the Minnesota Association of College Teachers and then Children with Disabilities Coalition and PACER.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Cindy Crest. I'm the Legislative and Policy Liaison for MACTE, which is the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, comprised of the 31 public and private colleges and universities in Minnesota that prepare teachers. We're going to spend most of our 2 minutes today having you get a chance to know us, because we're a very small organization. Several of us will try to cover your work, and the handout that we gave you will tell you about our legislative priorities. And I brought extra copies just in case anybody lost theirs from last week. So I started my career as an elementary special ed teacher. Then I worked in a state agency, and then I worked for the state university system in Minsky until I semi-retired in 2011.
Great. Madam Chair, hello. My name is Laura Mogelson, and I work at the University of Minnesota, which is a member of MACTE. I'm the director of Multiple Pathways to Teaching, which works in partnership with local districts in teacher preparation. I was a teacher in St. Paul Public Schools, and 8 years ago left teaching to work in teacher education.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Mackin. I had the privilege of working for 25 years in K-12 education, public and private, as a teacher, counselor, coach, and principal. And for the last 13 years, I've had the privilege of helping prepare our next generation of teachers, most recently as chair of the education department at St. Catherine University. So I look forward to representing the views of MACTE and answering any questions that the legislators have for us.
So the one thing I'll say about our legislative priorities this year is that we're primarily going to be focusing on addressing the teacher shortage and doing it through our partnerships with other organizations. Again, the way we try to maximize our resources as a small organization. We have lots of students and faculty and institutions, but they're all engaged full time, so it's a little hard for us to be up here. So we're particularly supporting work that's being developed by the Rural Ed Association, focusing on addressing teacher shortages in rural schools, the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers, and also some of what Education Minnesota is putting forward to address other issues that make it difficult to recruit and retain teachers in our classrooms. Thank you.
Thank you. One quick question, Representative Riddle. We want to keep moving.
I'm always quick.
Uh-huh.
The answer may be longer. But if you could just, and I don't want to get into detail here, but what do you think are some of the important elements in addressing the teacher shortage?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, there are many of them. Things that you've looked at in the past, like helping financially support students to complete student teaching. For many students, particularly students of color, that's a big barrier. They'll get their whole program completed, get up to student teaching, and then they can't afford the full-time commitment that requires, or even longer, as you've put forward an idea of year-long student teaching. So many of them are working full-time. They can't afford to do that. You know, paying them decent salaries that make them want to go into teaching and allow them to stay in teaching, that's another important one. Providing opportunities for paralegals through programs like Grow Your Own, programs like those that Laura was talking about, to help individuals move from, let's say, para status into teaching. So that's just three examples. There are many, many more that I could go into, but Madam Chair, I know you don't want to take the time today.
Thank you. So we have next the Children with Disabilities Coalition and the Pacer Center on deck, Mini Minds, and then on deck after that is Education Partnership Coalition.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Sarah Clark. I am here today on behalf of the Pacer Center and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. The Pacer Center, as you may know, is a parent training and resource center for our children and families with disabilities. Pacer serves families across the country and is based here in Minnesota. The Pacer Center leads the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, which includes the Autism Society of Minnesota, Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, International Dyslexia Association, Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, the Prader-Willi Syndrome of Minnesota, and the ARC of Minnesota. So you all have a copy of our legislative agenda. And additionally, I want to invite you all to join us for a tour at the Pacer Center sometime for the Assistive Technology Lending Library to learn more about the work that we're doing. And I want to thank you all for your service, and we look forward to working with you to improve outcomes for our children with disabilities.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then we have the Mini Minds Coalition, please, and then Education Partnerships up next. Feel free to sit down, and that way we can keep moving along, and then the PTA after that. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Chair Wickham and members of the committee, my name is Alberto Monserrate. I'm campaign manager for the Mini Minds Coalition. And the Mini Minds Coalition is a broad coalition of over 100 organizations and leaders from across the state with a common commitment to prioritizing Minnesota's youngest in need as the most important investment our state can make. Supporters vary in interest, size, and geographic reach, representing the education community, the philanthropic organizations, businesses, and nonprofits. We're committed to equitable access to high quality, accessible, and culturally competent early childhood care and education. You can see our priorities for this session in this document, and our full list of members in the back of the policy agenda. As you know, 90% of brain development happens in the first happens before age 5, which is one of the many reasons early childhood is so important to the future of our state. We want to thank the many members of this committee for your past leadership on early childhood education, and look forward to working with you on increasing quality and access for early childhood. Thank you.
Thank you. And next, Education Partnership Coalition.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erica Valiant, and I am a parent with the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. The St. Paul Promise neighborhood is an education partnership that puts children in the Frogtown, Rondo, and Summit University neighborhood of St. Paul on pathways to college and career success. By taking a proactive and preventative approach to closing the education opportunity gap by focusing on children early in life. St. Paul Promise Neighborhood is a member of a statewide network of collective impact organizations called the Education Partnerships Coalition. Members include St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, of course, NAS, as we call it, Northside Achievement Zone, Every Hand Joined in Red Wing, Partners for Student Success in the St. Cloud area, and Northfield Promise and Austin Aspires. All of these partnerships are locally controlled, data-driven, public-private partnerships dedicated to closing Minnesota's worst in the nation opportunity gaps. And before I finish, I just want to say that the main reason I'm here is because of those worst in the nation opportunity gaps. I have three boys, one in first grade, one in third grade, and one who's a junior in high school. And they're coming up in Minnesota schools. And, I believe strongly, of course, because I'm their mom, that they need to have, the best chances possible to be successful. And the only way they're going to have that is if we do everything we can to close these education gaps that we have here. So for all those reasons, we're so grateful for past support that the coalition has received. And we look forward to partnering with this committee to continue improving outcomes for children across Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Ms. Valiant. Next up, the Minnesota Parent Teacher Association, SEIU on deck, and then Literacy Minnesota. Go ahead and introduce yourself and state your organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heather Starks. I am president of the Minnesota PTA. PTA stands for Parent Teacher Association. I hope that you've heard of us. We were founded in Minnesota in 1922, so our centennial is coming up in 3 short years. And our national organization was founded in 1897, so we are one of the largest and oldest child advocacy groups in the nation. We are a membership-driven organization. Currently in Minnesota, we have 8,000 members across the state as part of 200 PTA units. Those units are located in schools all over our state, in urban, suburban, and rural school districts, as well as large schools, small schools, charter schools. We also span early childhood, elementary, middle school, and high school. So we've got parents from all different parts of the state. We have our legislative and policy agenda in front of you. I'm not going to go through any specific item because I've heard all of these already discussed in other advocacy groups. I just wanted to point out that on the front side, those are issues that Minnesota PTA is interested in from a statewide lens. On the back side, those are issues that if a PTA were to contact us and say this is an issue in our school or our district, we would support them in advocating for that at a local level, but it's not necessarily something that we would be advocating for statewide. Members of the committee, one of the things that I just wanted to highlight while I was here is that parent perspective and voices are crucial when making policy decisions. So I urge this committee in being intentional in how you find those voices and varying and diverse perspectives. So please reach out to your PTA units in your district or reach out to us and we'll make those connections because we want to make sure that parents have the opportunity to share with you their perspectives and their voices when policy decisions are being made. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Mr. Stinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Stinson. I'm the policy director for SEIU Local 284. We represent more than 9,000 school service employees, including clerical staff, paraeducators, nutritional service workers, buildings and ground workers, early learning staff, custodians, bus drivers, and higher education faculty throughout the state of Minnesota. Our local is working for a future where students in every Minnesota school have all that they need to succeed from pre-K to career. And our top priorities for this legislative session are special education, student lunch debt, and unemployment insurance for school employees. We know that school districts struggle to keep up with the mandated costs of educating students with special needs. We also know that appropriately supporting students with special needs is critical for their development and future success. Minnesota needs to find ways to streamline paperwork and other policy demands on special educators so that they can focus on their students. SEIU members, especially those who work in food service, are grateful for the work the previous committee did on student lunch debt. And I'm sorry that Sandra Erickson isn't here to be thanked in person. We know that hunger has a big negative impact on cognitive and social development and makes children far more susceptible to physical and mental illness, yet hunger is a widespread problem with just half of the students who are eligible for free breakfast receiving it, many families falling just outside the income limits for free meal programs or fluctuating in and out of that eligibility. Policy changes like the ones passed last year and unfortunately vetoed last year can significantly decrease the stigma faced by students whose parents are behind on their payments. And then finally, I mentioned unemployment for school district employees. It's just unfair that district employees are excluded from Minnesota's unemployment system, while private subcontractors doing the same work in schools are eligible. So we're going to want to continue to work with leaders in the House and Senate to fix that.
Thank you. Literacy Minnesota, and then Mr. Lindell, And then Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, can you, like, all come on down so we can get through these so we can get to our presentations? And I know Mr. Hellyer was going to speak at the end if he's here. So go ahead and introduce yourself and state.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Eric Nessheim. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Literacy Council, and I represent the Literacy Action Network. I apologize. We're listed as Literacy Minnesota, which is our old name. Our programs include GED, Adult High School Diploma, English as a Second Language, Basic Skills Enhancement, Family Literacy and Civics. And though AV is an education program, we've been deeply involved in career pathways programming, preparing students for employment in higher ed. We serve about 55,000 students every year with about 5 million contact hours. The funding formula that we are under right now is administered via a formula developed with statewide input and provides fair and equitable access to ABE in Greater Minnesota and the metro area, and it's actively supported by the vast majority of providers throughout the state. Since that formula was developed 20 years ago, there has not been an inflationary or cost of living adjustment, so we are lacking the funding to do the work that we need to do. Our platform for this year, we're requesting an increase in AB funding annually based on the percentage increase that the K-12 system receives each year. There's currently an ABE growth factor capped at 3% annually based on a rolling 10-year average of growth in contact hours. This only accounts for the growth in services, not the growth in the cost of doing business. At present, ABE is not receiving any funding under that growth factor. ABE services cannot grow or even be maintained due to inadequate funding. This money is budgeted each year by the legislature but not being spent, thus requesting the same annual increase as K-12 rather than the current growth factor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here on behalf of a number of organizations. I'm the Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education, and that organization works mostly on funding and tax issues. But like Roger Aronson said, we'll be watching the mandates, and I agree with him, having worked here as long as I have, that it's almost impossible to repeal something. It's far more difficult than passing something in the first place. So one of the things we're concerned about is Pathway 2 scholarships and making sure that Pathway 2 scholarships remain available, and then the other would be something to do with the streamlining of the testing. We have a lot of testing. We want to have that system to make more sense. I also work with the special education administrators. I think that we've talked a lot in the funding area about that, but also paperwork reduction, as Mr. Stinson said, is something that's very, very important to the organization. And also a couple of narrow provisions dealing with the identification for those with specific learning disabilities, moving from the discrepancy model to a model based on more on the MTSS approach. And then also, right now, there's the alternative delivery of specialized instructional services, the ADSIS system. Eligibility for that system is students identified for special education in a non-related area cannot receive instruction under that system, and we would like to see that changed, and we're going to be working. Well, there'll be bills coming on that. I work with the school social workers and the school psychs. Thank you very much for the hearing yesterday where the support staff were able to kind of outline some of the challenges that are in front of them. Again, from the school social worker perspective, a couple of relatively narrow things, and one of those would be the third party. They're not eligible for third party reimbursement for services beyond the evaluation for special education. So if they're providing services that are specified under the IEP, they cannot get third-party reimbursement for that. They would like to see that happen. And then also the social workers, the initial diagnosis for ADHD, they're prevented from doing that, and it's something that they would like the opportunity to discuss. And we are discussing that with licensed clinical, other licensed organizations that do have the ability to do that. From the school psych perspective, one thing that they're concerned about is the over-identification of students of color in special education, and certainly want to work to make sure that that is something that is discussed this year. Also then, from the school transportation perspective, and we're going back to special ed a little bit about the open enrollment, the difference in open enrollment for special education and open enrollment for regular education. We certainly want, that's something we would like to discuss. I know that there are a few bills coming on that as well. So I think Mr. Benjamin did a good job of getting all my paper to you, and I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And As we move forward through this session, please contact me with any questions you might have. Thank you.
And I think four organizations in 3 minutes is a record, so thank you. Then Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, and then Mr. Hellyer, if you wanted to take a few minutes right afterwards so we can get on to our presentations.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Minnesota is the birthplace of the charter school movement, and today there are 45 states, the District of Columbia, and several foreign countries that have charter schools. In Minnesota today, we have 163 charter schools that go from Grand Portage to in the far northeast to La Crescent in the southeast to Echo, Minnesota in the southwest to Bemidji in the northwest. But most schools are in the seven-county metro area. And this last year, 56,000 students, public school students, enrolled in charter schools, which is about 6.5% of all public school students in the state. In terms of who we serve in our schools, 59% of our students are students of color, and 54% of them are students who are qualified for free and reduced lunch. So we serve a disproportionate number of students of color and of free and reduced in comparison to overall public school enrollment. You have a fact sheet in front of you, primer on charter schools, so I won't go into that, but just to let you know that we are a membership organization of the schools. We are the equivalent of the School Boards Association, the Principals Association, the Teachers Association, and so forth for charter schools. You also have in front of you our agenda for this session, and I just want to point out on the backside the two areas that are appropriate for this committee to address. One is a rational approach for charter school facilities. When the charter school law was passed in 1991, charter schools were prohibited from owning buildings directly using public money. So over the years, schools have created affiliated building companies, another nonprofit that actually owns the building. And it's a very wasteful in terms of funding-wise and time-wise and resource-wise. Plus, it provides no asset for the state of Minnesota for the lease aid revenue that's paid to schools for their leases. So we'd like to redo that. And the other area is latitude for innovation, accountability. And there are some structural policy priorities and some specific technical changes, and they're listed there. And we hope to work with you during the session to address those. Thank you.
And it looks like Mr. Hellyer walked out, so we're going to actually start the presentations right now. You might be able to loop back with him afterwards. So I'm going to invite the Search Institute to the table here. And we're going to continue our laying the groundwork for folks to understand what kind of kiddos are in our schools right now being serviced. And he's going to do a presentation on what our children bring to the classroom and some of their barriers. I know he has some handouts for us. And very excited. I've heard about the Search Institute years and years ago, so when I thought about who would come in and be able to do the best job at explaining some of the assets our kids need, what them and the Bar Center were the first two that came to my mind. So Mr. Pacal, would you introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead and start your presentation. I'm going to, I know we said 20 minutes, you know, if we can keep it a little under 20 so we have more time for questions, and members will have about 10 or minutes or so for questions afterwards. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's very good to be with you. My name is Kent Pacal. I am President and CEO of Search Institute. We are a 60-year-old this year nonprofit. We conduct applied research on education, youth development, and we work with schools, youth programs, communities to implement that research. I am from a research organization, so I have to inflict a few charts and graphs on you, but it won't be too painful, and I'll move quickly. I know a lot of time as representatives, and you get a presentation like the one I'm going to give you, at least I imagine part of what's going through your mind is, well, what could we do to address this issue? And so I'm actually going to begin with one very tangible thing that I think you could do, and then hopefully, very quickly, Madam Chair, give you some of the why I think you should do it. I was on the technical committee that advised the state on Minnesota's plan under the new Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA. And as many of you may know, the feds required every state to adopt a series of indicators of school quality plus one other that they called the non-academic indicator. Minnesota adopted attendance. I can't give you the exact numbers, but I'll tell you I was deeply opposed to that, and most of the people in the committee were. largely because it's an indicator that doesn't capture a lot of what we are talking about today and what it sounds like you talked about in your hearing. When the previous administration proposed attendance, however, they did so saying it was an interim measure, and we wanted over time to find other measures of the context for learning or kids' social-emotional skills. There's pretty uniform consensus on it. But we went with attendance because attendance was the data we had and we could collect now. I would strongly urge the committee to work with the new administration and with the Senate to continue the conversation about how do we measure and build into our accountability system the context for learning and student success broadly, because if we stick with attendance for the next 5 to 8 years until the feds change the laws on us again, we will have missed a unique opportunity to address some of the things I want to give you a quick vision of right now. When the chair reached out and asked me to come and join your conversations, he said part of what you were trying to look at is how can schools address the biggest needs that kids have bringing into our classrooms today. And broadly stated, I think we could say there are external challenges and there's internal challenges. And the work that we are doing on what we call developmental relationships in kids' lives, we think research suggests are the single most, not the only, but the single most powerful thing that we can do in schools, in youth programs, and in families to help address those challenges. Let me give you a quick sense of why we think that's true. This is data from multiple studies that we've looked at. Kids who experience what we call a developmental relationship, and I'll tell you what that is in a moment, are 21 times more likely to report that they can manage their emotion than kids who have not. And all of these kids are kids who've suffered adverse childhood experiences or trauma. They live in extreme poverty. They've been a part of violence. They have lost a parent, something in that nature. They're 13 times more likely to report that they can persevere through difficulty. They're 9 times more likely to have a strong sense of purpose. They're 5 times more likely to report that they're socially responsible. So these are our kids facing the highest challenges that really any of us can face in life. Then there's those internal issues that often can reside within young people. We see that when kids experience developmental relationships, there's less likely to have attempted suicide, less likely to use alcohol, less likely to be using tobacco. And on the positive side of the equation, they are dramatically more likely to be responsible, to have strong decision-making skills, to have strong social-emotional skills, and to be caring. Now, I know that not any one of you is surprised that relationships connect to youth well-being. The critical question is, if we strengthen relationships, can we change youth outcomes? And so let me give you a very quick story from 3 separate research studies that I've compiled for the purpose of this presentation that I think really capture that power of what happens when we shift relationships to shift youth outcomes. And I apologize, because in the interest of time, I'm going to rush past a lot of subtleties. And if any of you want to get into the details with me afterward or in your offices later, I'd be glad to do that. This is a study that demonstrates how when kids are experiencing developmental relationships, it directly ties to their academic motivation, which affects powerful educational outcomes. There's a study that involves 7th graders in one school, so we have to be a bit cautious because it hasn't been replicated in other schools yet. But it was conducted by very, very careful researchers, the lead of whom is at the University of Texas at Austin. The school, it's important to note, was about evenly divided between white and African-American kids, and you'll see why I mentioned the race in a moment, because it turns out to be important. The researchers never interacted directly with the kids, and rather interacted with the teachers, but the teachers were not told the purpose of the study. The study all took place in the kids' 7th grade social studies classrooms, where the kids were told they're going to write an essay about their personal heroes. And the subject of the essay is probably pretty important, because presumably this is something they're interested in, not you have to write about the War of 1812 or mitosis or something like that. So the kids wrote their essays about their personal heroes, and the teachers graded the essays like they would normally grade the essays. No involvement from the researchers at this point. I'm sure you can't see it on the screen, but that's an actual essay from one of the 7th graders in the study. And if you can read it on the PowerPoint, the teacher marked it up like a good teacher teaching writing to middle schoolers would do. Some of the corrections are grammar and mechanics, and some of them are content, like what is a hero, what does it mean to be a hero. Up to this point, the researchers studying this had nothing to do, hadn't intervened at all. But at this point, the researchers asked the teachers in their own handwriting to write one of 2 messages on a slightly enlarged post-it note. Now, they had the kids write it in their own handwriting because they wanted the kids to think that it was a message directly from their teachers. And the messages were carefully structured. The first one was what the researchers called the neutral expectations message. And that message read like this. I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback on your paper. The second message was what the researchers called the high expectations message. That message read, I'm giving you these comments because I have high expectations and I know you can meet them. As you can probably guess, what happened then is the researchers took those post-it notes and randomly placed them on the kids' papers without the knowledge of the teachers and obviously not in view of the students. The kids got their papers back in a folder individually to lessen the chance that they would realize that the messages had been structured. What they wanted to carefully assess was what was the impact of these two messages and was it different based on the kids who were in the school. The results were quite striking. I mentioned that the kids in this middle school are about evenly divided between white and African-American kids. For the white kids who got the neutral message, 62% chose to revise the essay, correct the mistakes, and hand it in 1 week later, which was not required and for which there was no extra credit. White kids who got the high expectations message handed the essay back at a significantly higher rate, 87%. But what was really striking in the study was what happened with the African-American students. African-American students handed it back at a 17% rate if they got the neutral message, a 72% rate if they got the high expectations message. Importantly, a question I get asked when people hear about this study, all the teachers in this particular study were white. So there's a pretty dramatic impact of a simple, highly relational message on a student's decision to do something that's very educationally meaningful, revise an essay. But what's extraordinary about this study is they actually didn't stop evaluating the impact of this experiment after the kids wrote the essay. They followed the kids into eighth grade 1 year later, and there was no further intervention on the part of the researchers or the teachers in this particular study. And what you can see from your packets happened 1 year later was pretty extraordinary. This finding was so unbelievable to me, I didn't even make my own graph. I copied it from the research paper. What you can see there is that 1 year later, white kids who got both messages were no more likely to get into discipline trouble like suspensions than the African-American kids. But look what happened to the African-American students. African-American kids who got that high expectations message of, I have high standards for you and I believe you can do it, were significantly less likely to get involved in disciplinary infractions. And what was even more striking was they followed these kids 5.5 years later to college enrollment. And this is the finding that it's going to be striking to see if it holds up, because they're replicating this study now. But there you can see, for white kids, no statistically significant difference in whether I got the neutral message or the high expectations message. But 70% of the African-American kids who got the high expectations message and belief in seventh grade enrolled in college 5.5 years later, compared to 40% who got the neutral message. Now, if we were in a workshop with a lot of time, I would stop and ask you to have a dialogue about what might have happened there. But in the interest of time, let me suggest that at the core of this study and the story is probably the finding that when that relationship, that relational interaction between those teachers and kids was powerfully developmental, it not only expressed care, but it challenged growth. It changed the way the kids saw themselves, the way they saw learning, and equally importantly, it changed the way the teachers saw the kids, and in particular, those white teachers saw those African-American kids. And in that moment, that kind of a crucible moment in seventh grade, it may have changed how they decided to treat homework, how they decided to interact in class. It may have changed how the teachers engaged those kids, not just in the classroom, but in the hallways. So the takeaway there is that when we talk about the power of these relationships, and I know my former colleagues at the Barr Center will be talking about their work in this very same space, when we strengthen the relationships, we can sometimes dramatically strengthen youth outcomes. This is not just touchy-feely fluff stuff. This is foundational to the work that we're all trying to do and that you as policymakers are working to support. It's also work that there is an urgent need for, because there's growing evidence that along with the two terms that we've come to know over the last 20 years, the achievement gap and the opportunity gap, there's growing evidence that there's a relationship gap in the lives of the kids that we're trying to reach. Our data would suggest that there's 16% of kids have five developmental relationships with adults in their lives in various settings. These are the relationship magnets. They're relationship rich. 44% are kind of in the middle. 18% have one that they identify. But about 22% are saying, I don't have any developmental relationships in my life. If you take that seriously, and for any of you who've worked with kids, if one in five is disconnected from those kinds of relationships that help kids develop positive identity, agency, connection to others, the implications could be profound. This is our data, but research from Harvard researcher Robert Putnam is finding the same thing. If you look at this chart, you can see for middle and upper income kids, two-thirds of them report having what Putnam calls informal mentors in their lives, the same thing we call a developmental relationship. But look at the bar there for kids who live in poverty. Low-income kids, one-third, have those relationships. I went in and looked at Putnam's data, and I broke it down and found something kind of interesting. When you look across the types of relationships that they asked about in that study, poor kids and rich kids are just about as likely to have close connections to adults in their families. No particular difference in those two bars there. And actually, they're just about as likely to be relationally connected in their neighborhoods. No big difference there. But look what happens when we move into institutional settings or extended settings in these kids' lives. There's close connections to teachers, rich kids and poor kids. There's friends of the family. There's in my religious or youth groups. There's coaches. There's counselors. And for me, most striking, there's adults that are just beyond my family. So we're starting to see this relational gap in some of the kids that we are most needing to reach, kids who are living in poverty and need to overcome other barriers to learning. So final point here in my overview, if I simply came and told you relationships really matter and we can change relationships, but we never moved into the how-to, I don't think this would be a particularly useful finding. But our work at Search Institute is deeply focused on opening that black box. What happens in these relationships through which kids can be and become their best selves? And we're conducting ongoing applied research, some here in Minnesota, but most of it around the country. And the first starting point is when most of us say relationships in kids' lives, we think of that picture, caring adults. And what we're finding, caring is necessary but not sufficient if the goal is not just connection but development. So we're finding five elements of a developmental relationship are critical. Those five are expressing care, challenging growth, providing support, sharing power, and expanding possibilities. I'm just going to super quickly touch on them, and we've provided each of you with a handy poster to put on your refrigerator here at home, and we've shared some others with other folks in the room here. The key idea of expressing care is that the kid knows that they matter to the adult. If I didn't come back, you'd miss me. The next factor is challenging growth, and the critical idea there is no matter how well the kid is doing or how badly the kid is doing, they're always pushed to improve. And you can see that each of these elements of a relationship has very specific actions that you can do to bring it to life in your work with kids. The third is provide support, which is helping kids achieve tasks and complete their goals. The fourth, the one that frankly many teachers in our schools, and I started my career as a classroom high school teacher too, struggle with the most, and that's sharing power. It's giving kids voice and choice. That's a combination of helping kids feel respected, included, collaborating with them, and letting them lead. And then finally, expanding possibilities. That's connecting kids to people and places that broaden their worlds. When all of these things come together, it's like that moment when a new infant takes their first steps. Try getting them to walk if you're red-faced and angry. It's not going to work, expressing care. Challenging growth, that little brain and those legs have never before walked. It's growth on steroids. Providing support, you're literally there to help them take those first steps and catch them when they fall. Sharing power, I don't know about any of you, but I was unable to decide which day and time my kids were going to take their first steps. You can encourage them to take their first steps. You can create the conditions, but they're going to walk when they're going to walk. And expanding possibilities, their worldview is literally going to get a couple of feet taller when they begin to move. Finally, all of this is not just, as I mentioned before, touchy-feely. We can measure it. This is data from a sample of 25,000 kids of how they experience these five elements of developmental relationships. We can see with parents, care and challenge are the strongest. Expanding possibility happens the least frequently. With teachers, if you look at that bar, it's a pretty striking finding. 40% are saying express care is they experience with their teachers. 60% the challenge growth and descending from that point forward. To oversimplify a lot of complex work, there's two ways we're finding you can help educators and other people who work with kids build developmental relationships. One are practices and one are activities. And I'll click through this quickly. You have it on your slides. But the key idea of a practice is it's not a new thing for a teacher to do. It's how you give feedback, how you grade homework, how you teach a concept, how you talk in the hallways. And a relationship building activity is how you slow down the clock to get to know a kid for who they are. as whatever they bring into your classroom, all their strengths and all their challenges. The key idea of a relationship building practice is the young person feels connected to the teacher, the counselor, the social worker, while they're talking about math, art, literature. The key idea of an activity is I feel known outside the context of what you're here to teach me. One very effective practice I've seen is if you're trying to create a relationship with a kid and you're struggling, use the indirect praise practice, which means, and you can't do this inauthentically because kids have sensitive detectors for people who are inauthentic, praise the kid to another kid or to a parent. And when that gets back to them that you were talking about them indirectly, it's like potentially a light bulb moment that this person is thinking about me when I'm not there and cares about me. Or a relationship practice that we do with kids is help them map the relationships in their lives, and they begin to see that their well-being and their reaching their goals is going to be significantly shaped by the relationships that they build. One final takeaway, if there's one thing we're finding in our work, in particular with educators, that is nobody gets into this work not caring about relationships. It's just, are we intentional about them? Do we individually as educators, and do we as schools and systems put relationships first? So before you're working with kids, are you planning ahead for relationships? Whether it's in your individual curriculum or in your school schedule, are you making time for relationships? During, when you're in a relational interaction with a kid, are you cognizant of the fact that this is a moment like that post-it note experiment where they gave the message of belief and high expectations that could have lasting implications for what that young person does? And then finally, after, do you ever stop and reflect? Do you analyze how we're building relationships? I think a final image that I would sort of leave the committee with is this one, and I literally will end with it if I can get the animations back. And I don't need the graphic. Doesn't matter. It's fluoride in toothpaste. It's the active ingredient. I don't want anything I've said here today to suggest that the quality of the curriculum, the caliber of the educators, the status of the budget, the support services. I used to be in charge of busing in the school district, among other things, the transportation routes, all that stuff matters. And so relationships are necessary but not sufficient. But if that active ingredient is not present in a kid's experience of school, it's like brushing your teeth with toothpaste that has no fluoride or making bread that has no yeast. It's missing the thing that brings the rest of it to life. And what we're finding is that when we're intentional with kids and with people who work with kids about these relationships, I think it's the missing piece of a lot of our efforts to improve student outcomes. Madam Chair, I would yield my time if you want to do questions now or bring up the folks from the Bar Center. I will just say since I may not have a chance, Search Institute was very proud to support the work of Angie Jerebeck, who you're going to meet, who pioneered Bar as a counselor in St. Louis Park. And we were the initial home with federal funding of developing what has grown on to become a really wonderful program that is spreading not only across our state but across the country. And so it's really been exciting for us to see something that is homegrown here in Minnesota doing a lot of good things for kids, and that I think is very aligned with the work that I've just outlined very quickly for you here.
Thank you, Mr. Pakel. I think there was a ton of great information in there, and thank you for the handout. And I have a list of questions starting, so Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Pakel, I just want to validate a little bit of what you said. I spent 35 years in the classroom and dealt with thousands of kids, and you don't realize what impact that you make on students until sometimes many years after. I had fairly recently a student that I'd had, you know, some 20 years ago come up to me and say, you know, what really made a difference in his life and he felt his future success was one day you said to me, I know you can do better than that. You know, you should get in gear. You can do better. And, you know, he remembered all those years later. And you don't know. I don't know what in education now, if they stress to the student teachers, and they certainly should, to be aware that, you know, so many of the things that you do in the classroom that you think are nothing or inconsequential can have a very big impact on the students that you're talking to. Even the girl who last month commented on the black spot I'd put on her nose when she fell asleep in my class, So there's that too. But you know, you have to be cognizant as a teacher of the impacts that you can have for the future of these children.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Anybody with a question? I've got Representative Wasilewicz, and then we'll go to Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you know a little bit more about that the Post-it study, because I think that that has some pretty dramatic results, but I'm wondering if you know any more about kind of what they controlled for in terms of family background, income, achievement, any sort of things like that. I'm assuming because you presented it that it did do that, but I'm wondering if you could speak a bit to that.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the study that I referenced today, they did not control for family background other than income. They looked at income and gender, and they controlled for both of those. But you make a very good point. There could be other variables that they couldn't have necessarily factored. And in one school with one, there were 88 kids total in the group. There could have been other factors at play. The one thing is the improvement, in particular in the African-American kids, both, let's call it, effort and outcomes, was so striking that it's hard to imagine there wasn't at least some factor of the relational message there that was involved in it. But you make a very good point. When they replicate the study, they are attempting to get a much more, we would call it, granular data set to control for more factors. But they did look at gender and family income, and they found that the finding held with both of those controls in place. So thank you. It's a really important say. If someone like me shows up to a committee bearing research, you should always, I think, be interested but have all those asterisks, you know, in your minds. As I presented that partly, again, in the interest of time, pretty much without caveats. And we should always keep those caveats in mind.
Thank you. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I love everything that you're talking about, so I would also like to validate what you're saying. It seems to me that there's a difference between the art of teaching and the science of teaching. Hmm. And I believe that's sort of what you're getting at. I think most teachers that go into education do care. There is a caring element there. But the relational thing becomes an art. It becomes an art. So I'm wondering, are you involved in professional development programs? Are you involved in teacher education programs? I'm wondering where your institute is having the most impact.
Mr. Kell?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Christensen. We are deeply involved and getting increasingly involved in professional development and school, and we also work a lot in out-of-school time improvement. What we've created an initial way to get on the bus with us, that's an intensive two-day workshop called Getting Relationships Right. Next month I'm going to facilitate it for 60 Minnesota principals through the Minnesota Principals Academy in northern Minnesota that are from all over so that they can take it back to their schools and that they can be doing it. When we have the funds, our preferred model is to work with a school or a system for 3 years so that it's beginning to help people internalize these things, integrate it into what they do. Because kind of the enemy of anything taking root in Minnesota, really our other states today, is another new thing. It's just like toxic from the get-go. As opposed to exactly as you said, there's a science and an art to education, and most of us got into it for one or both of those, and we want to help people integrate intentionality in these things. I think, and Representative Erdahl talked about those stories of those students that come back to you, and I have it now from my teaching years through Facebook. We're not trying to suck the art out of it with the science, but I think we've learned the hard way, and this is one of the experiences that at least I had as an administrator in St. Paul during the years of No Child Left Behind. If those of us who believe passionately in this stuff, this piece of it, from whatever perspective, whatever side of the spectrum you come from, you believe that relationships and human connection matter to kids' outcomes, if we don't roll up our sleeves and bring data to the party and bring some scientific rigor with all of the caveats we were just talking about, we're always going to lose to, let's just say, people, whoever they might be, who only want to look at test scores or only want to look at an empirical. If we insist this stuff matters, which I know is not at all what you're saying, and we don't bring some rigor and precision to it, at the end of the day, you know, it's a cliche, what gets measured matters, and yet we don't want to just sort of weigh the pig. We want to help fatten it, to use a really left field analogy, and so that's where the professional development, the school improvement work comes in that we're doing, and we would, you know, love to do more of as we're continuing to deepen this work.
Thank you. Any more questions? May I have time for one? Thank you, Mr. Fickell, for the wonderful presentation, and we are going to invite the Bar Institute up with your stellar introduction of them already.
All right.
So, as Mr. Fickell mentioned, the Bar Institute is kind of St. Louis Park grown, and we have Angela Jarabek here, who's the executive director, and Rob Metz, who's the deputy director. And they're going to be presenting an overview of the Bar Center and what assets we can build upon in our students in our classroom, and be touching a little bit on some of those things our students face when they come in. So hopefully folks will have a little bit of questions. I think if they keep it under 20 minutes, we'll have at least 10 minutes for questions before we have to leave the room. So just raise your hand and we'll keep an eye out. And I have to say a personal shout out for Dr. Metz. He's our former superintendent in St. Louis Park Schools, so that's where Weavers met. I have no bias at all, as you can tell. So, Ms. Jarabek and Dr. Metz, you want to introduce yourselves and state for the record where you're from?
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Angela Jarabek, and I'm the executive director of the Bar Center. And BAR stands for Building Assets, Reducing Risks.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rob Metz. I'm the deputy director of BAR. Before working for BAR, I worked in Minnesota schools for 36 years, 10 years as an elementary teacher, then an elementary principal, then a high school principal, and I retired a couple of years ago as the superintendent of schools in St. Louis Park.
And why don't you go ahead with your presentation?
Sure. I want to first begin and thank Kent for all both the introduction as well as the information. I will say I haven't ever presented with Kent, and I will say it dovetails quite nicely. So it's really exciting to be able to share information with you as well as continue to build off all the work that these different organizations are doing. So I want to thank you for the ability to testify as well as kind of begin with a bit of a story. So in 1998, I was the high school counselor at St. Louis Park High School. It was the fifth year I had been in charge of ninth grade, and it was the fifth year that half of the ninth grade students had failed a course. So I was feeling incredibly discouraged. I was trying kind of all the best practices. I was doing one-to-one. I was going to the junior high. I'm talking to other teachers. I'm reading research, and I cannot get the failure rate to budge. So I actually went into the principal at the time to tender my resignation. I was like, I'm not doing what needs to be done. These students have got to pass these classes in ninth grade, and we know how important it is in terms of them graduating. And he was a great administrator that was able to frame things more broadly and said, you know what, this issue is not just with you or with our school. This is a national issue. And actually about 50% of ninth graders fail a course. And he said, I really encourage you to come up with something different. And so I will be honest, sometimes when you're young and naive and don't know that this is supposed to be a hard thing, you're like, that is a good idea. I'm going to come up with a new way to do high school. And so I did. And that was actually the beginning of BAR, which is, once again, kind of standing for building assets and reducing risks. So 10 years transpired, but after the very first year of implementing the model, we cut our failure rate in half. But over 10 years, we're continuing to have success. GPAs are going up, staff is happier, students are happier, and we're in particular closing the gap, which you're going to continue to see kind of our work on that. And I thought, this should work any place. I'm mobilizing the current staff here. I'm tapping into why they want to choose to be educators. I'm not touching pedagogy. I'm not touching curriculum. So this should be replicable kind of other places. So at the same time, there was a federal grant announced. It was called Investing in Innovation. And the goal was to be able to find, were there things that were working in the field that hadn't kind of been developed in the ivory tower, but rather working in the field, and could it withstand a high level of research, and could it be replicated other places? So I wrote for this grant, and I thought, well, I'm in a suburban school in the Midwest. I think this should work on the East Coast and rural schools, and it should work on the West Coast and urban, you know, in urban schools, and I'm going to apply for this grant. And lo and behold, received that grant, and that's what Kent was referencing. So Search was our applicant to be able to apply for this first research grant. And so we were really fortunate that we got funded. Now, I will be honest, my naivety also showed up because I said I was going to work in these schools, and I don't know anybody in California or, you know, the either coast. And so I'm calling friends of friends to say, can we find some schools that want to do this and actually participate in this research? So within that, you know, beginning time, I found a rural school in Maine, as well as an urban school in California that said, yep, I want to start doing this. And so that's kind of how this has now began. And now, as you'll see, we're in 15 states as well as D.C., and we have about 100 schools participating. But once again, kind of back into our kind of our grits of St. Louis Park. So the BARB model itself is really predicated on two pillars, which Kent actually referenced, you know, in terms of the importance. One is positive, intentional relationships. Now, we lean into relationships from staff to student, staff to staff, and I believe that staff to staff positive relationship is really critical when you're looking at equity issues. And the second is student to student. The second pillar is data. So you need to have authentic data to have authentic relationships. So we want to be able to have transparency in data, both in terms of what the school typically produces. So I want to have attendance and grades and discipline, that information needs to be coming readily to the teachers, but I need that information to be not just the math teacher sees math. I need the math teacher to know how the student is doing in physical education, how they're doing in art, how they're doing in English. So they really have a 360 view of the student, as well as I need every adult in that building to be attentive to qualitative data. I need them to be able to see, are you in Minnesota and you're not wearing a winter jacket? Has your friend group changed? Do you seem passionate about basketball? But I need every adult to be attentive to that qualitative data and share it. So when we put those two pillars together of intentional relationships and data, you'll really be able to transform the school. So as you'll see, we have 8 strategies, and I'm not going to go into them, but I do want to say that there are 3 that we actually have behavioral anchors that we can observe. And so one of them is the SEL curriculum, that basically is a way to come and observe what do those adult relationships with students look like, and can we coach to improve that? The other is the teacher team meeting. What does that look like, adult to adult, and how can we improve that? And the third is risk review, which basically is the interaction from the school to community resources. And how does that look? So when we have professional development and coaching come in, we have things that are able to be observed, and the school can improve on it. So the BARB model itself is a professional development and coaching model that lasts 3 years. Strengths. Having a strength-based approach is critical. It's critical in terms of how our schools work, but I think it's critical for all schools. So this happens to be our tagline, but I will be honest, I think it's really how schools should be looking at kind of all of the work that they're doing. When we talk about same students, we're really talking about all students with a really intentional lens on equity. We need to make sure that all students are being successful, in particular those students who are farthest from opportunity. And so as you'll see, we're working in a lot of different settings, and so we know that there's a gap in every setting, and we ask the school to frame it by saying, what students in your school are farthest from opportunity, and how we're going to get services to them. The next is same teachers. We do not need to replace our teachers. We have very talented teachers in our schools. We do need to give them another system to operate under. So we've been able to, we're working in charters, we're working in publics, we're kind of all across the country, but really holding up that teacher profession. The unions are very supportive of our work because they're able to show that we're able to make changes in our school without having to disrupt who the teachers are. And that third piece is really critical, that better results. We have to be able to show that the work that we're doing is making a difference in both students' and teachers' lives. So kind of back to, I'll hit some data slides because as Kent said, when you're coming from a data lens, you have to be able to share some of those pieces. But in general, all of our schools that are taking the model on have had significant impacts within a year, typically a failure rate reduction of 35%. St. Louis Parks had a passing rate now of 85% for the past 20 years. They've been able to, in essential, close the gap, especially for graduation rates. Our African-American graduation rate was 93% for the last couple years when the states have kind of hovering right around 65. So those better results of being able to measure that in both what is the experience, what is that qualitative experience, but then back to those school measures. The students need to be passing their classes. They need to be learning more. They need to have opportunities in front of them. So as I've referenced, the I3 competition really set up our work to be able to do studies. So I applied for that first grant in 1999, and we did our first study in California, and we were doing within-school randomized control trials, which I'll explain a bit about that. But we had a lot of success with that, which then set up that we got another funding in 2010 to basically validate the study. So the federal government basically said, go any place you think this will not work. And as being an educator, I did not want to tell any school this would work unless I had proof that it did. So we're in Appalachia. We're in Boston. We're in Dallas. We are in Baltimore. We are in Charters. We are in Publix, rural, urban, suburban. Basically, any place that people said this shouldn't work, I'm like, let's go do it then. And if it doesn't work, we can tell people, don't try it here. So that's kind of why we've ended up so scattered in terms of our country. This has been a federal research grant. And then in 2013, we received the scale-up grant. So we are the only model from the federal government to receive all three rounds of the funding, and it's been based entirely on our outcomes, that we've been able to show that we can continue to replicate this, that you can teach adults to build relationships, and that those relationships can be transferred into kind of actual school outcomes. So the study itself, the validation study, what we did was we would go to a school and we would say, we want to randomly assign your ninth graders to adults that we're training and coaching or to kind of school as usual, because we're not going to touch the pedagogy, we're not going to touch the curriculum, we're not going to touch the schedules, we're not going to touch buses, we're not going to touch anything. And so then if your school wins the basketball championship and everyone's happy and you say, well, that's why we did well, we'll be able to call that out, because we'll be like, well, everybody won this championship, or if you had a tragedy. So the first thing was there's been very few within-school randomized control trials done, especially at the high school level. Many people said you can't build a schedule for it. I will go back to the fact I was a high school counselor, and I said, I can build a schedule for anything. I can build this. So the fact that we've been able to show that we can do this high level of research has been a significant contribution just to the field in the study, to be able to say you can do this. And we're not taking away any services for students. We're just adding this coaching on. So you can see kind of where the studies have been done, and in particular, you can see that we have about 75% of the students of color and about 75% free and reduced lunch. So we've been at all parts of the country, and then we've been pulling this information together. AIR is a really significant or kind of a big contender of our research partner, so they've been a third-party researcher that have been doing the study. So our model is basically predicated on that we first believe we have to change teachers' attitudes and behaviors. And our work, again, is with the adults in the building. We're going to be measuring student impacts, but our work is with the adults. So the first thing, and I think something that's really significant, is there's been a notable change on teachers' kind of perception, in particular around their collaboration and their view of their colleagues, as well as their use of data. Those effect sizes are both over 1.0, so those that are interested in statistics, those are really high impacts. So they're now seeing their adults, as, you know, these other people in their school as being resources, and they're seeing data in a new way. The next piece is we need to really look at what the impact is on the students. So we had a number of impacts on the students, but some pretty significant ones, and I think ones that are important, is both expectations and rigor and supportive relationships are showing up as significantly changed. And Kent referenced that. You need to have supportive relationships, but you need to have high expectations. I can't just care about you and then not expect things. So really having the sense of, I expect you to do well, and I'm here to support you. But I think the big win is the transferability. So what's happening is the students that are in VAR are having a significant impact on reduction of failures. They're passing courses at a much higher rate, both for all students, but in particular if you look at students of color. So the fact that we are now having this level of attention on our students who have often been the most underserved by, you know, having this intentional relationships, using data in a real-time way, they're passing classes at a much higher rate. We also have similar information around GPA as well as college-going behaviors, but that this type of intentionality of relationships are literally transforming schools and students' trajectories. And then the kind of the big win. So can you move standardized test scores, NWE maps, which many know are very hard to move, especially at the high school level? Can you move them within a year? And can you move them with your lever only being relationships? And the answer is yes. We are showing that the students not only are passing more classes, they are doing better on standardized test scores in both math and reading after this type of coaching and this type of exposure to kind of having schools being... Basically, we're taking relationships and we're operationalizing them and having them being integrated into the school system. So we have many validators that are, you know, kind of vetting our work. So CASEL, once again, is very interested in kind of the social-emotional status of the schools, and they've listed us kind of in their effectiveness, as well as ACT. So we have a lot of information that this intervention in ninth grade is continuing to shape that trajectory, just like that Post-it note. And so ACT had named us kind of the College and Transition Award in 2014. But the one that I really want to bring your attention to is evidence for ESSA has listed us as strong evidence four times for reading and math. So if you go in for evidence for ESSA and you're looking for what is a reading strategy, they will list FAR. They will list how do you improve math. They will list FAR. Now, we're having schools call and say, okay, what math book should I be using? We know I want the evidence for ESSA. And we're like, you can use whatever math book you're using. Now, I say that with caution, that there certainly are models and other, but we know that your students will do better if you have this model in place on top of it. So I think that that's been, in particular, a really significant win for the federal government to be able to see that this type of transformation is going to make a difference in math and reading. So kind of some closing things are kind of, how are our students showing up and how do we kind of know who these students are? So I think that one of the biggest pieces is having systems in place to be able to recognize who the whole student is, having the ability to discern kind of those pieces of kind of who are the students and how do we share that information to really get a 360 view of the student. So in our model, we both have systems that we're really training those adults to know who the students are, but then also a way to share that information with each other. So one of the pieces that I guess in a story is probably a strongest illustration, we were working with a really large school, and kind of early on a team meeting was happening where we had three teachers teaching different content areas, and the teacher came forward and said, I have three girls that are skipping my class every Friday, every Monday, 14-year-old girls in ninth grade. And so I think they should get a detention. And they share this with the BART coordinator. Next teacher said, you know what? I saw those same girls. They're not sitting with the ninth graders at the lunchroom table. They're sitting with a bunch of seniors. They should get a quiet lunch. Next teacher says, you know what? They're not making dress code. They should get a dress code violation. So the BART coordinator takes this information and says, I'll get back to you, recognizing that all those things were discipline. Comes back 2 days later and says, they're being sex trafficked. They're being shipped out Thursday night. They're being shipped back Monday night. They're in foster care. Well, none of these individual observations would have been that alarming to any individual teacher. But when they were able to put those things together, they were able to get this view of these students that were once again going to have many consequences coming, and they're 14 years old, versus being able to say, we, the adults in the building, both know these kids, and you see things without always registering it. So us, really working with the schools to say, how do we have a system that we can be able to share this information in a really intentional way to make sure we know who these students are, to get them the help that they need so they can really be successful. Now, that's an extreme example, but you can imagine that's kind of what's transforming these schools and why these students are being so successful. So I'm going to have Rob share a couple more stories about some of the students, and then we'll kind of move on and to have some questions.
Good afternoon again. For most of my career as a school administrator, I implemented academic interventions with the hope of obtaining academic results. So, for example, I changed curriculum. I upgraded teacher professional development. I adjusted grading systems. I beefed up the teacher performance evaluation system. And I had some success. But the realization that the relationship-based interventions that are part of BAR produced far greater academic improvements than I had ever seen before was a real game changer for me, and I became a true believer. I've almost never met a student who did not want to do well in school. Every student wants to be successful. Most Minnesota students today are more diverse in areas such as race, ethnicity, economics, religion, gender, etc., than ever before. Each student is a unique individual endowed with their own individual gifts and talents. They bring these individual perspectives, gifts, and talents into the schools they attend. Of course, many students are burdened with a significant number of personal stressors, including those that accompany poverty, racism, immigration, violence, mental illness, trauma. Other barriers are much less student-centered and are more institutionalized. These are the types of barriers that schools must effectively address. When I was an elementary principal, a small group of students came up to me one day and said, "You must be really rich, Mr. Metz. You own the whole school." I explained to them that I just worked at the school. The school really belonged to them, their families, and the community members who supported the school. As a school principal, I always believed that it was my job to make sure that the school met the needs of the students who walk through the door every day, whoever they may be. As a high school principal, I would test how well we were doing by asking students if they felt as though they truly belonged at the school. Were they really free to be their full, unique self in every way? Or were there parts of themselves that they felt they had to hide when they walked in the door in order to fit in? Did they truly feel like this was their school? Or did they feel like they were visiting someone else's school? If they didn't feel like they fully belonged, then the school was not aligned to their needs and the school needed to change. The fundamental insight behind BAR is exactly what we're here to talk about today. You cannot have great teaching, great learning, and great academic success until it is possible for adults to understand and respond to every student as both a learner and a person. And that is very possible to do.
So I'll kind of hit a little bit of the barriers, and I'll open up to questions. So I think some of the barriers are the history of secondary schools. I will say I do take offense when people say schools are failing, especially secondary schools. I think schools are doing what they were designed to do, and we have not changed the schools as now we've expected them to do things there differently. I mean, it was only in 1972 when we now moved the, you know, you could leave at age 16. So the fact that we now need all students to graduate but really haven't done much to change how that, you know, that system works, I feel like, you know, that's what the failure is. It's not that the schools are failing. So that's, I think, a barrier. I think the other piece is evidence-based. I believe really strongly, and you cannot be asking both limited resources to be going towards activities or using teachers' goodwill until you have evidence that it works. So regardless if it's BAR or other things, there's a growing body of evidence of things that have worked, and then there are also organizations that are intentionally choosing not to research their organization and just kind of going fast on legacy. Feel really strongly that as we're moving forward to really make sure that we are leaning into things that are evidence-based, to make sure that we have a high probability if you actually do this, you should get results. I think the other piece is SEL needs to be integrated into the curriculum. It can be, I'm going to go to music class, I'm going to do physical education, I'm going to do SEL. SEL has to be just an integrated part of how schools operate. And then the final is finances. So I think, once again, making sure that there are resources for things that are evidence-based. When I referenced the 13 schools that are doing BAR in Minnesota, all of those are either part of the federal research funds or philanthropy. And there are other states that are now prioritizing making sure that evidence base comes. And I guess as a homegrown model that's being effective, I would love that to be part of a conversation, that we can find ways that, that schools can access finances to do things in particular that have evidence around it. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm open to questions if there are some.
Well, thank you so much for that. I'm sorry we don't have even more time to hear about some of the assets we need to build and some of the barriers kids are facing, but I know we're going to continue that discussion. I have Representative Mary Kunish-Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. It's interesting, I look at your list of schools that are participating. I represent St. Anthony High School.
Oh.
And then I teach in the Robbinsdale area schools, so I'm at the middle school. And so I was wondering if you might ask a couple of things, or answer a couple of things. Are you, when you, between Armstrong and Cooper, are you finding a very large difference, or you have to approach things a little bit differently? And I know that, that the students that we serve in those high schools are a little bit different than the students that, that we have at the St. Anthony High School. And so what are some of the variables, and how do you approach those a little bit differently?
So in terms of Cooper and Armstrong, they're part of our scale-up study. So to be very clear, Cooper started this year, and Armstrong can't start until next year.
Oh, okay.
So they had to be a delayed start, so they're being measured against each other. What I will say is many of the schools that we're working with are the lowest performing schools in the country. So the schools in Baltimore as well as in Dallas. So to that point, we go to the school and we ask them kind of what their goals are. You know, and so we had one school we're working with where almost 60% of the staff quit mid-year, the year before we came there. So one of their goals was to simply kind of stabilize their teaching force. So as much as we are still measuring the outcomes for students, we really do go to the school to say, what are you seeing as a need? And how can our coaching, which is once again, when you're focused around relationships and data, what can we do to be able to do that? I also appreciate you referencing St. Anthony, because St. Anthony is a higher performing district, as you know. And so we actually had been advised at one point, they said, well, this is only for low performing, you know, schools, which I'm like, relationships really should be for everyone, but let's do a randomized controlled trial at a high performing school. So we went to St. Anthony as a high-performing school, and we were able to show statistically significant that students who had this coaching did better on test scores, did better on all those other things. So St. Anthony was kind of a proof point as part of the validation study to be able to show that relationships, shockingly, are needed for all humans.
And Representative Barr. Bennett.
It's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I find this really interesting. I love that you're evidence-based, and I'm a former teacher myself, and I know how important relationships are. Mm-hmm. So two questions. One's really short, so I'll ask both questions at the same time. I mean, the answer will be short, I'm sure. First question is, do you have an elementary school program? And the second question is, on the BAR model, what is it's either one-time or I-time curriculum to foster a climate for learning? What is that?
Mm-hmm. So the elementary model, we're actually piloting next year. I will be very honest. We had targeted secondary schools just because of that ninth grade piece. And very quickly, many districts said, this is just going to be the way we're doing school. So we're in 13 middle schools already in other places, and now we're piloting elementary next year. So we're in that place. And I-time, so once again, in the spirit of trust and candor, when I was the ninth grade counselor, I said in ninth grade, it's all about them, guys. Let's take 30 minutes a week, pronoun I. This was before an iPhone, an iPad. It really was I-time. So this is a social-emotional curriculum that the adults facilitate with the student. So I think the thing that's different, it's not delivered to the student. So one of the first activities is what's on your plate, where the teacher is also listing what's on my plate. I have three kids. I train for marathons. I do these other pieces. And the student lists what they do. So it provides a way to form a relationship. It also provides context right away. So when, in fact, perhaps a student doesn't turn an assignment in, the teacher doesn't automatically draw an assumption of they don't care about my class. They go, oh, I know they had a baseball tournament this past weekend, and I know they're taking care of three siblings, and so I'm going to engage in a conversation versus making kind of a notable assumption. So I-time happens weekly, and that's actually what we observe. So we have lessons that they do, but it really is a way to facilitate that conversation and that relationship.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that first administrator didn't let you resign. That was really good. This is, like Representative Bennett said, this is very intriguing. And how do you, I think the question I would have is, and we heard it before the testimony, before you got there today, is a lot of the teachers, which is, again, in my mind, the heart and soul of these educational places, and they have these new ideas coming out all the time. How do you transition a teacher then to really have the buy-in? Because if that's not there, this isn't going to go anywhere. So what is that secret potion? What is that magic that you bring to the teachers so that this actually does work when you bring this to them at the beginning?
I think one of the biggest pieces is the solutions are the teachers, and they have a lot of professional autonomy. So I'm not getting into the details, but one of the key pieces is you need to have a teacher team that is sharing a group of students. The kids don't have to travel together. We can work in any schedule. But once a week, you need to have a teacher team, English, social studies, and math, that are talking about the students, and it is up to them to come up with strategies to have the students pass. So it is not teacher-proof. It's not – basically, we're saying you know the kids. You know your school. How can you make this kid tick? One of the other pieces is every conversation about a student leads with, and you have to log, what is the student's strength and how am I going to leverage that? The other piece is you end up with this new relationship with these other adults because you have the comfort to say, I'm not connecting with this kid. But, you know, Mr. Metz, I know you are. Mr. Metz is like, I coached their brother. I know their dad. Yep, I'm going to take that. But you now are working with your colleagues in a new way to have a shared responsibility. But bottom line is teachers love this, because it's giving them a ton of professionalism to be able to, because basically we're like, the students need to be able to pass, and we think you know how to do it. So you need some ability to be able to try that. So we are coaching you weekly. We are giving you prompts. And one of the big things is we are pushing you to run data. We need data active. Every 3 weeks, I need data runs. And I need data runs by subgroups. I need all students, but you know, have that be also run by Latinx and Black students to say how they're doing, and then give that back to the teachers.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just so, is it more clustering then with teacher groups, and is it actually more collaboration with those same teachers, more collaboration time that they were getting than they did prior to the BAR model? Is that the thing they're getting extra of? Is it extra time to collaborate? And also, what happens and what has happened to sort of that class size model. Is that a big part of this too?
Thank you. We state for us to come and work with the school, we need two things. We need someone to coach because we want this to be a sustainable model, that this is not us doing this work. So sometimes it's the principal, sometimes it's the math teacher, but we're like, we need somebody to be coaching once a week, an individual. So that at times is a cost to the school, sometimes it's not, depends. The other piece is at minimum we need teachers meeting once a week. Some schools are using their PLCs. Some schools are using, you know, kind of different times. In California, we've been working in lots of schools in California. They've had to pay their teachers outside of time because they don't have a prep period. So it really is up to the school. So we're saying those are the two non-negotiables. We are confident every school we've worked in has had a change, but that's what we need. We need to have an adult to talk to.
Okay, we have about three more minutes before we have to get out. There's a 4:15 coming in, but I have a Representative Erdahl and then Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because the St. Anthony School has been brought up, my son is an administrator and baseball coach there.
Oh, great.
And so I can get a firsthand synopsis of how it works. But does this work in coaching, too? Like, he's a baseball coach. Would he be using that with that?
Mr. Beck or Mr. Matz, either one, real quick.
Yes, I'm an old, frustrated high school coach myself. So I would say yes. I mean, coaching is a good example because as a former high school player and coach, you know, there were coaches that you really would just do almost anything for. My old football coach, I would run right through that wall if he asked me to today, and I'm almost 60 years old. There were other people that I would not even go out for their sport because I didn't connect with them. It's a really good example because what we're doing is creating a structure within a school where many more adults have the opportunity to build relationships, strong relationships with many more students. It's a very systematic way of doing it. It's a very intentional way of doing it so that you're creating many more multiplying effect of those kinds of relationships in a school for students.
And then one last question, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony. Angela Jerbick, last name? I have a lot of Jerbicks in my district. Are you from Silver Lake?
I'm not.
Oh, no. Okay. That's just a side note. Anyway, I can see, you know, the BAR program creating a lot more communication between staff and identifying things as far as the students are concerned could be good. I do always have a certain level of skepticism as 16 years in the school board. I've been through the outcome-based education profile, learned, you know, these are going to be the end-all, be-all, and most of the time a lot of the teachers didn't even care for the reform. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you're getting a buy-in here. But to me, one of the measurements is, you know, we had some real hard testimony yesterday on mental health, okay? Mm-hmm. And so obviously academic achievement and success helps negate some of that. So do you see with the BAR program, are you measuring, is there a reduction in mental health problems? And also we have an excessive amount of labeling and drugging in this country and state. Mm-hmm. Compared to other countries, are we seeing less labeling and drugging under this program? To me, you're helping the lowest common denominator if you see reductions in those two areas, if you're measuring that.
Ms. Mm-hmm. Jerbeck?
So what SAMHSA has listed us in NRAP as an evidence-based model to reduce risk factors. So what we've seen is a reduction in students using drugs. We're seeing a reduction in discipline incidents. So in terms of the mental health, my hope actually is that we're able to identify students who have these needs and get them resources much quicker. And I think that's what we're seeing at schools. And so there has been, kind of depending on the setting, we're working in some settings. Our school in Baltimore had 200 homicides in a two-block radius around the school last year. So, I mean, the reality is sometimes the goal for the student is simply to keep them coming. Maybe they're not going to pass the class, but we need them to keep coming, and we're going to get them outside resources. What I wasn't able to speak to, just because of a certain time, our risk review component is all the community intersections. Basically, we're saying the school can't handle it all, and we need to coach you in getting those outside resources in place. We need the teachers to identify the issue and then get the students to the appropriate resource and then give direction to the teacher to be able to say, we've identified the student is dealing with lots. We need you to be a safe adult. We don't know if it's going to be reasonable that they're going to do homework with what's going on, but keep them coming. And when they come, don't shame them for not doing the homework.
Just one quick follow-up comment. But, you know, I do differ with you on the textbook. I think it is important that you use the correct academic techniques, intensive systematic phonics versus whole language, traditional grammar, and spelling versus inventive spelling and creative writing. It makes a big difference in the academic performance of the children. So I do think there's a difference there.
I apologize. I want to make sure I'm clear. I wasn't at all saying that we thought any curriculum was better. We were just saying that the school can make those choices and that wasn't something that we were going to come in.
Thank you for the clarification, Ms. Chirbeck. And I want to thank you both again so much for coming in and the Search Institute. I hope it was helpful. I'm sure they'll be willing to have questions in the hallway. Quick announcements for next week. We're meeting Tuesday. Going to go over here from four different school districts that have been doing well in closing the achievement gap. And also on Wednesday, we're going to be meeting and hearing from the Education Commissioner and then have presentations from the Standardized Student Testing group that had the task force. And then Representative Bennett's bill, and we may add more bills too. So with that, we're adjourned.